I want to thank Helga for sharing her first-hand experiences with us of her trip to Palestine. I also want to thank her personally as a Palestinian for a Jewish woman to put her body in the line of fire to help bring awareness to the plight of my own people is something that personally touches me very, very deeply. And I don't think that I can ever express the kind of gratitude, or that Palestinians as a whole can ever express the kind of gratitude that that kind of act deserves. We don't choose our situation there. Palestinians don't choose to be there. They have to be there. And they endure those sufferings as a matter of resistance, but also as a matter of not having much of a choice. And for people to choose to go there and stand in solidarity with them is just an enormously courageous act. And I hope that more people will be moved to do the same kind of thing in the future. I'm going to shift gears a little, though, and talk a bit about... I'm going to start a bit with the role of universities in student organizing and in social justice organizing in general. There's been a lot of talk, even in the lead up to this event, about intellectual pluralism and ideas of diversity and ideological diversity, one could say. For example, Hillel co-president, I believe his name is Elliot Glassenberg, said at the end of an article about this event, when political activism on campus reduces itself to shock effect and radicalization, as has happened at Concordia, instead of focusing on true dialogue and intellectual pursuit, they are not truly educating or helping anyone. First of all, I want to take issue with the idea that what happens at Concordia is radicalization and shock effect tactics. What's happening in the world is shocking. The use of depleted uranium weapons on civilians in Iraq, that's shocking. Babies being born with organs outside of their bodies, that's shocking. Conveying those truths to people in a way that hits home to them, if that shocks them, well, that's a byproduct of what you're talking about. And if that radicalizes them and mobilizes them to movement, then thank God, because it means that they have a sense of social justice, a sense of what's right and wrong in this world. I also want to say the idea of intellectual pluralism is something that's being bandied about a lot these days. There's a Republican senator by the name of Santorum who is a co-author of something called the Ideological Diversity Bill, which is being proposed in the United States. This bill and similar initiatives in Colorado under the banner of intellectual pluralism being put forward by a group called Students for Academic Freedom and being heavily propagandized by a man by the name of David Horowitz, talk about how universities should restrict themselves to the discussion of issues in their curriculum. He says, for example, he says that the university exists only for the limited purposes of teaching and research, and reasons that since the university is a community only for those limited and distinctive purposes, it is a community which cannot take collective action on the issues of the day without endangering the conditions for its existence and effectiveness. I have to say, this idea is, it's shocking, first of all, that we should pretend that we live in some kind of island in universities that are disconnected from our communities. There is no boundary between the university community and the community at large. Universities are public institutions in Canada, for the most part, especially. And they're spaces where communities come to have concerns presented about different issues. There's all kinds of lectures by community organizers all the time. At Concordia University, at McGill University, there is no hard and fast distinction between the walls of the university and the community outside. I also think this is really dangerous because what's being advocated here is that punishment for professors, for student organizations who express an opinion, who take a moral stand on issues of concern happening in our world. These people would prefer that you don't express an opinion, and at the same time, they make this justification saying that students will then feel free to express opinions. Well, if your professor is scared to death of expressing an opinion, how are you going to learn by their example that it's okay to express an opinion? You're not. And what's going to happen is that we're going to lose our capacity for critical thinking and for changing the society that we live in. It's amazing, too, that these people at Students for Academic Freedom, for example, Campus Watch, Daniel Pipes, I don't know if you're familiar with that site, he makes a list of professors who are too soft on the Middle East and its climate of human rights abuses and various other things. Too hard on Israel and too soft on the Arabs, Daniel Pipes. He says that what he's trying to do is hold people to higher academic standards, but they're the kind of higher academic standards that I've outlined to you here, a kind of academia that's totally disconnected from the world within which it resides. And what can possibly contribute in terms of anything to that world if it exists as a sole island unto itself? These people would have professors monitored for every thought and action, scrutinizing it for its relevancy to the curriculum, penalizing them for caring about the world they live in. This while our politicians can run around brazenly mass murdering the poorest and weakest people in the planet, personally enriching themselves. You know, Bechtel, I don't know if you're also familiar with Halliburton. Dick Cheney was CEO of Halliburton for 5 years. He still gets severance pay from that company, and they received one of the largest rebuilding contracts after the Iraq occupation. So we're not talking about, we're not talking about personal accountability for these individuals who are receiving money directly into their pockets while people are being murdered in the name of some war on terror. But we're talking about holding professors up to a stringent system of accountability. We're talking about having security, for example, at events where these kinds of issues are discussed because of the possibility that this might radicalize the population. Well, maybe it's time for a bit of radicalization, because without that capacity for critical thought, without discussing these issues, we're heading towards, really, it's a recipe for totalitarian fascism. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's where I see it heading. And it's incumbent upon us to challenge these ideas head on. If we want to talk a bit about September 9th today, what we could look at, for example, the protests at Concordia, what we could look at was what September 9th protest was a response to, which is the monopoly of force by the powers of the Israeli occupation, the powers responsible for the Israeli occupation, by police brutality, by the Montreal police against students who are engaging in a sit-in to protest the accommodation of a man who came to slander the Palestinian struggle and its resistance to occupation by equating it to the terrorism of Al-Qaeda 2 days before the one-year anniversary of September 11th at a school where 1 in 5 of the students is Arab and or Muslim and where social justice organizing around a variety of issues is very strong. It was a deliberate provocation. And the reason that Concordia was chosen is because Concordia is a context in which Palestinian solidarity organizing has been extremely effective in raising awareness around the crimes of the Israeli occupation and apartheid, and strongly linking that struggle to other social justice movements and grounding it in an anti-racist discourse that centers around the ideas of dignity, land, and justice for all. Palestinian solidarity activists and their allies have actually enriched the learning environment at Concordia, and they have attracted new students from all over the country. Enrollment is at record highs at Concordia right now, as the administration is trying to distance itself from what happened on September 9th and penalize those who were involved. I've never seen more students who come to Concordia, particularly because of the kind of learning environment that happens outside of the classroom. See that you agree with me that people are attracted to an environment of critical inquiry and thought and especially action around these issues to build more just and humane communities where debate about the issues fundamental to our humanity can occur without fear of sanction, retaliation, punishment, etc. I, for one, am not ashamed of what I did on September 9th. I went, I chanted, Free, Free Palestine, Netanyahu Assassin, the people united will never be divided. There's nothing to be ashamed of in doing that. To me, it was an important day in lifting the veils from my eyes about the true state of our democratic freedoms in an increasingly corporatized institutional domain where profits come before people. I may be old-fashioned, but I still believe that the lives of human beings are worth more and have a value that heavily transcends that of some material objects, inert material objects. The powers that be seem to have forgotten that a life is not a number. It is a sister, a mother, a father, a brother, a lover of someone else who's not going to so easily accept that that life was destroyed for a few billion-dollar contract for oil services or for weapons. It's important to talk about these things and to remember that there are alternatives to the logic of consumerism, especially in our universities. And we have the right to fight and reclaim our dignity, our space, to demand things like that police be banned from campuses, because that's a provocation to students when police come onto your campus. And to do that, to be politically organized and dissent without fear of death, be it physical, psychical, or professional. Because there are attacks on your credibility when you go out on the line like this. You get called an anti-Semite, you get called a racist, a whole slew of things. Your words are misinterpreted, but you have to stay strong to your message and stay strong to what you know is true and right. I also want to say, let me just skip ahead because my thing is a little bit muddled here, but in terms of the critical thinking that I was talking about, this critical thinking becomes very, very important when our anti-racist discourse that we use in our social justice organizing is being appropriated by the very bodies that seek to silence us. Okay? They use words like, for example, Concordia Administration, instead of holding a public inquiry into racism and discrimination, as was called by the student body in a general assembly, they decided to set up an intercultural competence and diversity board. Right? So, like, they think that we need lessons on how to be interculturally competent and respect diversity, which is really funny to us, since in our social justice organizing, as you can see, we are diverse. We are very diverse. We have no problems with diversity. It's the administration that seems to have a problem with diversity and should be taking lessons from their own intercultural competence board. But this puts us in an awkward position where we're saying things like, fuck diversity, right? We can't say that. We can't say, fuck diversity. We can't be like, no, you know, screw your intercultural competence and diversity board. Because these are the words that we use when we're talking about the kind of world that we want to create. And when we're talking about making a practice and theory that faithfully reflects the principles of self-determination, dignity, and justice for all. Okay, and when we read things like ideological diversity and we read tracts by these authors like Horowitz and others who talk about the marketplace of free ideas, we can hear those resonances in the idea, the neoliberal discourse of free trade, which means freedom of movement for profits, freedom of movement for goods, but no freedom of movement for people, right? And it's these ideologies of the neocons, okay, like Wolfowitz, Pearl, Rumsfeld, and others, and Zionists, Christian and Jewish Zionists, and I think there are some Muslim Zionists even, who try and put this binary, this us versus them binary, this dichotomy, which doesn't exist. This is a construct that is manipulated by these elites in order to keep us divided and keep us from turning our eyes onto them and what they're doing and fighting amongst ourselves instead. I also want to say a few words about anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism these days is unfortunately becoming used as a label almost exclusively against those who are critical of Israel. And I say that, and I have proof to back up that assertion. Recently there was a poll in Europe where people were asked, out of 14 countries, who's the biggest threat to world security? And there were a bunch of options. And people chose Israel as the number one threat to world security. 59% of Europeans chose Israel. In second place, tied for second place, was the U.S. With North Korea and Iran. They were all tied. Iraq was after that, because presumably the threat is neutralized now. In response to the poll, leaders of the Zionist establishment, which are not representative of the Jewish community as a whole, in most cases, denounced Europe Europeans as anti-Semitic. Okay? Some of these same leaders work for the Anti-Defamation League, which is a body that just last month awarded the Statesman of the Year Award for 2003 to Berlusconi, the president of Italy. Berlusconi, just 2 weeks before receiving this award from the Anti-Defamation League, denied that Mussolini had killed any Jews or that he had anything to do with the Holocaust. Okay? So if the Anti-Defamation League, which is supposed to be standing up for, you know, looking out for cases of anti-Semitism, sees fit to give an award to Berlusconi after he denies that Mussolini has anything to do with the Holocaust, and then turns around and says that Europeans are anti-Semitic when they say that Israel is the greatest threat to world peace, then, well, you know what I'm saying. Anti-Semitism is becoming a term that is being exploited by this Zionist establishment to mar the reputations and the credibility of many courageous people who stand up against the disgusting apartheid and occupation policies of successive Israeli governments. And those people include Jews. So the Anti-Defamation League, we can assume, is now the, you know, anti-anti-Israel league, because it's not really doing its job as the anti-anti-Semitic league right now. I also want to go on just quickly. I know I have to finish here. So I was going to say a lot more on that subject, but the importance about the importance of getting involved in campaigns in your communities, in struggles that are happening in your communities. Right now, there's a situation of about 100 Palestinian refugees in Montreal who are facing deportation. I work with a group called Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, and I also work with a group called No One is Illegal. And both of these groups work actively with the Coalition Against the Deportation of Palestinian Refugees to raise awareness about their struggle, about why they left the countries of origin, where they hold no citizenship in most cases. For example, most of the refugees here are from Lebanon, most of the Palestinian refugees, where in Lebanon they don't have the right to work in over 78 occupations. They don't have the right to own property. They don't have citizenship. They don't have the right to travel freely. They're basically stateless individuals who came to Canada and made refugee claims, and their claims have been refused. Many of their claims have been refused. Unfortunately, reforms to the immigration system in Canada, which it was flawed to begin with and only got worse after that, reforms in June 28, 2002, resulted in one judge presiding over each person's case, and that one judge holds the future of the human being in front of them in their hands. And a lot of these judges are biased against Palestinians. They make biased statements in their decisions. They show ignorance about the situation where these Palestinian refugees are fleeing, the countries that they're fleeing. And basically what the refugees have done as a result of this is they've self-organized with the support of groups like the ones I mentioned and another 130 actually organizations that have endorsed their demands, which are an end to deportations and the regularization of their status here in Canada. And I just want to say quickly that, you know, if Palestinian refugees who don't hold citizenship anywhere in the world are being rejected by our immigration and refugee system, that means there's something really wrong with our immigration and refugee system, because these are the quintessential refugees. I mean, they have nowhere to go back to. And it's clear that our system is fundamentally flawed if it's rejecting these individuals. Today, actually, we dealt with a big hit. One of the people who is involved in the organizing, who is a Palestinian refugee, 23-year-old Ahmed El Abdelmajid, he was yesterday abducted, basically, by immigration officials and taken into detention. He was taken into Laval Detention Center, which is where they're holding refugees now, because apparently you're a criminal if you want to, like, improve your lot in life or expand your opportunities or escape persecution, you're a criminal. When you come here, we now detain people based on a whole set of new ideas that we have about Arabs and Muslims, especially since September 11th. This individual was taken into Laval Detention Center, and we were assured he wasn't going to be deported. We were assured he was going to receive a hearing to hear his case again, a last-minute kind of appeal thing. That was yesterday. We had a 48-hour guarantee. And then today, just after we spoke to him on the phone and he was like, I'm looking forward to my hearing, you know, maybe they'll release me. The next time we heard from him, 2 hours later, he was calling from the U.S. border where he was being held by customs officials and is going to be put into INS detention because he passed through the United States on his way to Canada. Okay, and since June 28, 2002, we have something called the Safe Third Country Agreement, which means that any refugee who comes to Canada to make a claim, if they pass through the United States on their way, they get sent back there because they should have made a claim in the first place that they were able to make a claim. But as we know, the way the United States is treating Arab and Muslim refugees and immigrants right now, most people, we should actually be accepting refugee claimants from the United States who are Arab and Muslim who are facing persecution. We should not be sending them out. So that's it. I'm just going to get out on that note.